Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher, and my guests today are Sandra Lane, a professor of public health and anthropology at Syracuse University, and a research professor at Upstate Medical University, and Peter Dunn, the president and CEO of the Community Foundation in Syracuse. They're both joining me to discuss the problem of lead exposure in the Syracuse area. Professor Lane, Peter, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So let's start with the problem with lead generally, and then I want to look more specifically at the case of Syracuse and the nature of the problem, what can be done, what hasn't been done, what could be done in the future. So, Sandy, let's just start, though, with the problem with lead. Just sketch out briefly for us, if you can, what are the harms that lead causes, and how is it usually transferred into humans?
So we've known about the problems of lead for over a century. Lead is a poison. It is toxic to brain cells. We say it's neurotoxic. There is no normal amount of lead in the body. So the normal amount of lead is zero. Over time, we've been able to test children to see that it harms them at lower and lower levels. So now we worry if a child's blood lead level gets to 5 or greater micrograms per deciliter. Don't worry about the micrograms per deciliter. Just think of 5.
Okay.
So children who are exposed to lead as toddlers before the age of 2 or 3, when they do a lot of hand-to-mouth behavior, you know, they're sucking their thumbs, they're etc., they can get exposed to lead in houses that have lead paint in the under layers of paint. It's mostly dust in windowsills and door frames. That's most of it. Mm. Also, it can be in the soil around the house, and in some localities, it can be in the water. And it has been here, but I believe that it's improved here in the water, not eliminated. So children who are exposed to lead as toddlers have lower rates of what we call executive function. They don't problem solve as well, and they're more risk-taking. This is because lead destroys parts of the developing brain, and you don't get that back. So in adolescence, kids who have been exposed to lead as children, boys, adolescent males, are more likely to be arrested. And the higher the lead, more likely to be arrested for violent crimes. Girls who are exposed to lead as little kids, we have found, my research team, are more likely to get pregnant and get pregnant a second or third time during their teenage years. And this is because when girls get into trouble in adolescence, it's often reproductive trouble.
Mm. And so in addition to that, then, I assume that part of the other damage that occurs is in simply one's ability to learn and
absolutely.
Achievement. And
absolutely. And in Syracuse, where we have had historically and still have an alarmingly high level of children affected by lead poisoning, in the Syracuse City School District public report card for all of the third graders in Syracuse, only 11% of them are reading at proficiency level. And this is an absolute emergency.
So, Peter, I want to get into some of the things that the Community Foundation is doing, but let me just pursue this with Sandy here for a minute. One last aspect of the medical nature of this. So children are tested for this by a blood draw, I presume?
Yes. Okay. Right now they're recommending capillary blood. You just stick the finger and get a little bit of blood.
Like a blood sugar test sort of?
Yeah. Okay. At year 1 and year 2.
Okay. Because one question I was wondering about in terms of getting tested was whether if there was a substantial blood draw involved, that might put people off of getting tested. So that's not a problem.
It's just in the pediatric clinic, and the kids have to go there anyway for their immunizations, which is a needle stick, and they get another little needle stick. It's not a very difficult or it's minorly painful.
And then one last question on this. Can lead exposure hurt adults? You focused in on children and particularly young children.
It absolutely can.
Okay.
There are some studies of people who progressed to kidney failure earlier if they had been exposed to lead. Pregnant women who were exposed to lead poisoning as little girls, when they are in the second trimester of pregnancy, especially if they don't have enough iron, zinc, and calcium in their diet, the lead will come out of their bones and then affect their fetuses. And it is associated at that point with low birth weight.
So passed down then.
So if you think about lead, which is kind of invisible to most people, it is associated with school failure, with risk-taking, with adolescent crime, with teen pregnancy, with early death.
So, Peter, Sandy mentioned a couple data points about Syracuse, and I know that your foundation has looked at this in addition to trying to do some other things to actually intervene. So let's just talk about the problem here still, and let's look at Syracuse. Can you give me a brief sketch of the dimensions of the problem as you found it in Syracuse, and maybe anything in particular that really leapt out at you and just knocked you over?
So you can look at this on a county-by-county basis and then in Onondaga County and Syracuse down to the census tract basis. So in Onondaga County, about 5% of the kids have elevated lead levels. In the city of Syracuse, about 11% of the kids. If you go to particular census tracts within the city of Syracuse, up to 1 in 4 kids, or 25%, in certain neighborhoods are poisoned with lead. So that is particularly distressing. And if you were to overlay those census tracts with other indicators like poverty, eviction rates, how many times a family moves in a given year, all sorts of things like that, you'd see some alarming commonalities. So in the spirit of that, the home environment can affect learning, can affect family dynamics, violence, all sorts of other things, this issue started to concern us. We've been active in this space for about the last 6 or 7 years, but we sort of backed into it, is what I would say. We started creating a table of community folks, the city, the county, nonprofits, activists, folks who cared about affordable housing and housing issues through the Green and Healthy Homes Initiative about 6 or 7 years ago, and really backed into lead. It just kept coming up as an indicator of significant concern.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Peter Dunn from the Community Foundation and Syracuse University professor Sandra Lane. So, Peter, let me continue down this path. You looked at this a few years ago, and now you've been looking at it since then. My understanding is that the incidence of elevated blood levels of lead in children in Syracuse has most recently gone down. It's still a problem, not suggesting it isn't, but what can we attribute that recent decline to?
Over the last 5 years, the elevated levels have gone down from around 16 or 17% in the city to around 11%. And that's encouraging. And that shows a good level of collaboration between the city and the county. One of the distressing things is that we haven't had the benefit of federal funding for some years through the Housing and Urban Development Department. However, that just came back. The city just got a $4 million grant to help with lead remediation in homes, and they work collaboratively on that with the county. So folks are working together. There's collaboration. Nonprofits are at the table. There's lots of good stuff happening. But if you look at the data, it's encouraging that numbers are coming down. But on a particular census tract basis, when you've got neighborhoods where a quarter of the kids are poisoned, that's really distressing.
And Sandy, on that point, much of the attention on this problem is focused on low-income populations in the city, and I can understand the reason for that given the numbers that you've already been citing. But it also sounds like if it's 5% across all of Onondaga County, that the problem is not just in low-income housing. Is it spread out across the region?
That's not accurate, actually.
It's not. Okay.
My research team looked at Onondaga County excluding the city of Syracuse, and
okay,
it was quite low.
Okay.
So if you add the city of Syracuse numbers into Onondaga County, yes, it dilutes the statistic. But it doesn't mean that there's a lot of kids getting lead poisoning in the county outside of Syracuse, although there are some.
And in those instances, again, it's coming primarily from the paint?
Primarily, yes. Okay. But we can't afford to entirely avoid the soil.
Okay.
And this isn't exclusively a Syracuse issue. Any legacy city with older housing, and in Syracuse, 90% of the housing is built before, you know, the 1940s. So you've got that issue. And if you go out beyond Onondaga County to Cayuga County has some particularly distressing data as well. The west side of Auburn has higher lead rates than any neighborhood in Syracuse. So wherever you have old housing, you're going to have this issue, but it's more prevalent in some than others. But Buffalo, Rochester, Utica all have very similar issues.
But it's not just older housing.
Yep.
When I first came back from Egypt, I lived in San Francisco, and I told my child's pediatrician that we had to look out for lead because I had been aware of it in Egypt. And she tested her whole practice. And, you know, almost all the houses in San Francisco were built after 1906 because there was a big earthquake.
Mm.
She had almost no children in her practice, which was middle class and upper class children, that had any elevated blood lead. So in Syracuse, we've looked at it a little bit more deeply, and it's dilapidated rental housing.
Okay. And say a little bit more then about how that manifests itself.
Yeah. So we've been focused on two lanes in this work. One is resident-owned housing, and the second is tenants and tenants exposed through landlords or through properties that haven't been kept up. And where we see the greatest incidence is in the tenant space, where you have tenants who are eager to find a place to live. You have a lot of substandard housing. You may have landlords that don't live here, may live in other places. And as a result, you get a power dynamic between landlords and tenants that's unfortunate, and people who feel like because of that power dynamic, they can't even report the fact that they've got unsafe conditions. There are some encouraging things going on around the city administration looking at this issue, looking at a lead ordinance that is modeled on some work done in Rochester that would help address that. But really, the issue is fundamentally in the tenant space. That's where you have the biggest problems.
But I would like to say that we shouldn't simply blame the landlords. Mm-hmm. If we do that, the landlords will pull out and we'll have more homelessness. So the landlords shouldn't be – they're not in a not-for-profit business. They're in a for-profit business. We shouldn't expect them to do more than the law recommends or mandates. They do what the law mandates. The law is inaccurate, and it's not enough.
I want to get into that in the second part of our conversation. You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and my guests are Peter Dunn, the president and CEO of the Community Foundation in Syracuse, and Sandra Lane, a professor at Syracuse University and Upstate Medical University. And we've been discussing lead exposure in Syracuse. So let me come back to this question. You were talking about the main problem being rental housing. What are the different ways that this problem can be addressed? Is it a question of the lead paint not being well enough covered by newer paint? What is exactly the problem with rental housing that creates the lead exposure?
Where you get the lead exposure is primarily windows and doors, porches and floors, right? And mostly windows and doors where there's friction that causes dust and causes paint flaking. So what you can do is make a home lead safe. You can't. It's very expensive to remediate it entirely, make it lead free.
That would be stripping everything down, and I imagine very expensive process.
Right. Yeah. So we focused, as I mentioned, we backed into this and looked at the data and found what are the ways that we can help as a philanthropy to move things along. You've got government funding. You have a variety of private sources. How can philanthropy really help move things along? We made a $2 million commitment over 4 years to try a variety of activities in focused census tracts to try to make a measurable difference. The preponderance of our funds will be going into remediation of tenant housing. And so we're providing, through Home Headquarters, grant funding to swap out windows and doors, to provide funding for landlords so that they can invest in their properties and incentivize creating safe spaces for people. We're funding the land bank in Syracuse to help them test all the houses because they've got a lot of older houses, that so they know what they have. We're funding new affordable housing that is developed in these areas. And then we're funding neighbors understanding the issue. So TNT is a neighborhood network within the city. We're funding them so they can do grassroots, really neighbor-to-neighbor education, among other things. So there's lots of strategies but they're focused on the built environment.
Is there a way to test? I wanted to get into this testing issue because in some of my reading, it seems like that's where things have not been done that could have been done. And Sandy, you're nodding your head, so I want to hear more from you about that. But is there a lesser expensive way to test for lead? What are the different?
Well, lead testing is not that expensive.
Okay.
There are instruments that people use that County Health Department can go out and test a home for lead, but the remediation is a bit expensive. It's not very, very expensive. They've done this in Rochester with a local ordinance that it was put in place, I believe, in around 2005 or 6. And this was led by a principal in a local elementary school who was concerned about the reading level of his students, and he realized that many of the students had been lead poisoned. So what in Rochester they did was remove certain parts of the window sills, the friction parts, and remove the friction parts of the door sills, mostly. And that was enough with encapsulating paint on the firm or flat surfaces like the walls. That was enough, Rochester found, to lower the risk of lead poisoning. It doesn't entirely eliminate it, but it lowers it. And that's why dilapidated rental housing has more risk, because people who live in older housing in Syracuse, it might be beautifully maintained.
So if the testing isn't that expensive, then let me get into one of the policy questions that struck me as I was reading through some of the material I was looking at and preparing for this. And I'll ask this to both of you, but it's a question about relative priorities. And Peter, your foundation, you know, has been a leader here locally in making it a priority. But I was pretty surprised to learn, at least I thought I learned, that no private homes were inspected for lead paint by the county or the city last year prior to their occupation by low-income residents who are getting public rent support. And I read that in the Post Standard, so I'm going to go with that. Now, the explanation that I read for that was that there wasn't money for that. And immediately I asked myself the question, there's money for other things in the city, class of new city police, firefighters. So I'm wondering about priorities here. But I mean, shouldn't this be something that we as a community should be funding first rather than last? And while it's great that non-government community partners are helping, I can't help but ask, shouldn't this be a core function of the government?
Every dollar that you spend on lead remediation or lead exposure prevention is worth somewhere between $20 to $200. Right, in avoiding lost income, educational expenses, health condition costs, and whatnot. So it's a good investment to do lead remediation, number one. There is a movement to create a policy structure that would allow for rental housing to be inspected every 3 years. So the real issue is the smaller units, the 1, 2, 3, 4 size units in the city. To have them really be inspected, to be tested, inspected for lead, as well as other code violations. The city has made some progress in creating a new system for its code enforcement. So all these things build on each other. Mm-hmm. And so we're encouraged by the progress in that lead in the dynamic of addressing it. Certainly more funds could be invested. The state has expressed an interest in this issue, and something showed up in the budget that was just passed around defining lead exposure. But most of the money comes from the federal government.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guests are Professor Sandra Lane and Peter Dunn from the Community Foundation. So, Sandra, I think you wanted to jump in on that. Go ahead.
Well, poor children don't vote. We've had this problem for a long time. My research team produced a report at the request of the CNY-led task force that we published in 2008, and my students and community members presented this to the Common Council at that time. There wasn't the political will to deal with it. And I don't know what to say. Poor children, I would guess that they're mostly children of color, but not entirely, don't have the priority of the government.
Mm. And as we've talked about it, the notion of children being the canary in the coal mine, mm-hmm. they're the ones who are functionally being tested for lead poisoning, right? They're the ones who are showing where the homes are being lead exposed. That makes an impact on people. And I feel like we've been developing over the last year some significant momentum around it. The county executive and the mayor both talk about it in their annual addresses. The legislatures are activated, so that's good. Yeah. It's regrettable that it's taken 40 years since lead was restricted in paint in the late 70s and 10 years from when you did your study, but hopefully we're starting to get some progress.
So, Sandy, you mentioned before laws not being what they should be. From a policy perspective, what other kinds of changes would you like to see then going forward in order to really help this problem?
Well, obviously, homes should be inspected before people move in and not waiting until children are lead poisoned by them. There have been some homes historically in Syracuse that have poisoned several generations of children. So this houses don't reproduce. You know, they're there. So the other thing is, in 2016, we had 31 murders in Syracuse, putting us per capita at a rate of murders almost as high as Chicago. Mm. There's 325 gunshot episodes in Syracuse, according to the police. How many of those young people perpetrating violence were lead poisoned as children?
So, Peter, what kinds of things then is the Community Foundation looking at going forward in order to help address the issue?
We're looking at this on a couple of different layers. First, we want to support direct investments in affordable housing or in remediation to existing housing, especially where tenants are concerned. Secondly, we want to support the network, and that includes the Green and Healthy Homes Network that is staffed through home headquarters, as well as organizations like the Land Bank that are a critical cog in the housing dynamic here in Syracuse. And we want to have neighbors engaged. So that there are a couple of different layers of action involved, as well as policy. One of the things of policy that we're finding is there are things you might not even think about that affect this. So an example is source of income. In the city of Syracuse, a landlord can't discriminate on source of income. That could mean Section 8. It could mean disability. It could mean alimony as your source of income. Any legal source of income, you can't discriminate. In the county, yeah, you can. And so that has the effect of concentrating poverty in the city because someone who might have any one of those sources of income, a landlord can choose not to rent to them outside the city. So there's things like that that I think actually you'll see some action on at the state level over the year that affect the dynamic of where and how people can live. Mm. And what we came at when we came at this as an investor really in things like literacy, college access through CES, all sorts of things. This is an issue that undermines all of our other investments.
That's a good way to put it. So if someone is relying on this, let's just call it substandard rental housing, they're aware of this problem of lead. You're shaking your head, no, they won't be. All right, well, let's say they are, and then we'll talk about the awareness. What is it, though, that they can do at that point? I mean, can you call the city and say, I want this to be tested? What can you do?
You can call the county. You can ask for it to be tested. Then you have to negotiate with the landlord to get remediation. And now, with these wonderful programs, there's more opportunity for remediation. And I am over the top glad about that. But most people don't know that their children are lead poisoned. We mandate testing children at age 1 and age 2, and my research team has interviewed parents in focus groups who were not told their child's lead level. I would like to see an ad on TV with a parent and maybe talking to another parent, one asking the other, so what did your doctor say your child's lead level is? And have the parent say, oh, I didn't ask. And have the first person say, well, let's call the doctor right away and ask.
So let me make sure I get this straight. Make sure I heard you right. The testing is mandated, correct?
Yep.
But there is no requirement of passing that information on.
No.
So what is the point then? Is it to collect the public? Is it to collect the public health information?
The doctor would know about it, but physicians and healthcare providers are limited in how much time they can spend with parents, and if the parents have lots of needs for care for their children, immunizations, maybe ear infections, they may mention it. The parents that we interviewed don't know about it. There's no mandate to tell the parents. There's no little card that you give.
That's astonishing. And so we've only got a few seconds left, Peter. I'm sorry I'm going to put you on the spot here at the very end, but anything that you're hearing there that then the Community Foundation can be thinking about to raise the awareness of this?
We haven't quite gotten to that level of issue yet, I'll say. My understanding is that about 66% of the kids are tested in Onondaga County, and we have one of the best testing regimens in the state, but still only two-thirds of the kids. So okay. There's that issue, and then there's do the schools have access to that data so that the schools know it when the kids show up?
The schools should know it because the teachers are being blamed when the students don't learn to read at grade level, and it's not – they're entirely their fault. This is something that happens before the children get to school.
This is a huge problem, and obviously it's something we're going to need to revisit on this program. But I want to, for now, thank the two of you for taking the time to talk with me. That was Peter Dunn from the Community Foundation and Professor Sandra Lane. Thanks to the two of you for speaking with me.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, Conversations in the Public Interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.